If you enjoy this episode, you should subscribe to Proglodytes Radio Podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Every episode of Proglodytes Radio Podcast features commentary by myself and Thomas on progressive rock and metal music, and we feature interviews with interesting progressive musicians. You should also consider leaving a review on iTunes to let us know how we're doing.
Eddie, are we going to get dinner tonight?
I don't know if we'll have dinner tonight, Arthur Jr. Daddy cares so much about prog rock that he's spent a lot of time and money creating Proglodytes.com and Proglodytes Radio Podcast. If we had a fantastic sponsor to help us at least break even on the website, that would really make things a lot better. You might even get that scarf you always wanted, so you can stay warm when you're walking barefoot to school in the snow. If anyone out there would like to inquire about becoming a sponsor of Proglodytes Radio Podcast, they can just contact Jim at Proglodytes.com. That's J-I-M at Proglodytes.com. Stay warm, folks. Welcome to Proglodytes. My name is Arthur.
And I am Thomas.
And we are happy to bring you the second part of the Matt Page interview. Matt Page from Dream the Electric Sleep.
Which, and, by the way, I went and saw them at their CD release party here in Lexington. They played with the Wild Jays, which is kind of like a psychedelic rock band from Nashville, and Jandragon, which is kind of a mathy, prog-ish group. Both were fantastic. Both were really, really great. But Dream the Electric Sleep, they closed out the night, and they rocked the place. They were awesome. There's a forthcoming review. I'm going to do a little concert review and talk a little bit more in depth. But needless to say, they were just great. Dream's new album is out. Definitely check it out.
Did the crowd roar like a lion?
The crowd roared like a lion. It was awesome. It was a knockout.
It was a knockout. Rock over London.
Rock on Chicago.
So, I was listening to the radio today. Here's the thing that annoys me about radio interviews. Time limits. So, like, there's a person being interviewed, and then the interviewer is like, okay, you've got 30 seconds to make this point. That gets on my nerves, but podcasts don't have that. See, that's a good thing about podcasts.
Yeah, and people are always interested in everything that people have to say. So I bet you were listening to On Point with Tom Ashbrook, right?
You're like, my jaw is open, man. How'd you know that?
Because I always get frustrated at how short people's time is on that, too.
I like Tom Ashbrook.
Oh, he's,
I think he's
awesome.
Cool.
He's a fantastic
I'm pretty sure he's
interviewer.
Listening to this podcast, too.
Yeah, I know he's definitely a proglodyte. No, I'm a fan too. But yeah.
Yeah, were you listening today?
I wasn't listening today, sorry. Sorry to disappoint you.
That's okay. I need to borrow some of his techniques for shutting up a phone. Yes, we got the picture. All right. Is that right? All right, you made your point. All right, anyway.
Yeah. I just imagine some really red-faced caller somewhere in wherever. Yeah. So, prog news. We got some interesting things going on in the prog world. So, Arthur and I read this interview with Steve Howe on prog.com. And we're trying to see how we feel about it. So, as you listeners probably know, because you're prog fans, there's Yes, which has basically Steve Howe is the member who's been in there for the longest. Chris Squire passed last year. Rest in peace. And John Anderson's no longer singing. It's John Davidson from Glass Hammer. I think Billy Sherwood's playing bass, right? And Jeff Downes is playing keyboards, and Alan White's playing drums, but he threw out his back or something. He's in some sort of pain, so he can't do the shows that he's going to do this summer. So really, you have Steve Howe, who's kind of the holdout member for more than one Yes album. Meanwhile, you have on the other camp, Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman, which all three of those guys were on at least one. Wakeman and Anderson were on a ton of Yes albums, and Rabin was on Big Generator and 90125 and Union. So you see Steve Howe throwing shade, being all salty, when it sounds like Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman are a little more Yes than Yes. And I bet that kind of hurts him. Do you think that makes him mad?
Well, so the quote. So this is Steve Howe's quote. I would say good luck to them, you know. I can't do a Steve Howe. Can you do a Steve Howe?
No, keep on doing exactly that. Oh, no.
Dude, all right.
Last time I saw them, they were singing Your Move, and I was listening to their harmonies, and I just heard him over to the side going, don't surround yourself with yourself.
I need to qualify my impression, though, because Steve Howe really is like a heroic character. Like, when I was 15, I wanted to be Steve Howe. He was just the man. So I don't want to disparage Steve Howe. Steve, if you're listening, you and Tom Ashbrook, I don't want either of you to think that we don't like you or we don't want you on the show. But the quote is pretty, I don't know, it's hard for me to actually grasp the context. Like, I can read it in a really charitable way and it's not so bad, but good luck to them. You know, there's been cover bands out playing Yes, and we're delighted really that there's more Yes music being out there getting played. Anybody can play Yes music, and hopefully the bar is set very high. The standards of quality and perfectionism are set pretty high for Yes already. I think it's good to have demanding environments for it. Okay, so, close quote. So, it's just such a weird quote, because it almost sounds like his point is that these are it, so it's basically a cover band,
right?
That he's happy that there are people out there who are deigning to play. Did I use that word right?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Jim Britt's technique is, if you use a word but you're not sure that you're using it right, just point and say it loudly and stare people in the face as you use it, as though to challenge people to, you know.
Yeah, I
got
you.
Said
I got
it wrong.
You. And so, anyway, yeah. The less time we dwell on it, the more credibility you might have had.
The point is, it just sounds like it's really hard to get out of this quote without thinking there's some sort of antipathy.
Passive aggressive. Yeah, because he's like, anybody can play Yes, you know, there are cover bands out there, when actually John Anderson like audition Steve Howe to play for him? Like, can you really call any band that John Anderson is singing in like a Yes cover band?
Yeah, that's
when actually like the guy from Glass Hammer, who's a fantastic, I mean, we saw him, we loved seeing him sing, like he like matched the magic of John Anderson, but at the same time, you know, he was in a way channeling John Anderson when he was doing John Anderson's work. So I think he would probably even he would admit, like, yeah, I am trying to like channel my best impression or do the best like version of John Anderson that I
or just
can
tap into the ethos of John Anderson. Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't wish either of them ill. I think that's great that Yes wants to continue on with different members, and it seems like they get along, and there's cordial, but, you know, here's the hard reality of this, dude. This is going to happen more, man, because these guys who started in the mid-60s, they're getting old. So, like, I hate to say it, but we're going to see a little bit more of, like, we're going to have to kind of brace for it. It's been a hell of a year for a lot of artists, really. Like,
yeah, so they're saying Alan's not feeling good. Alan White.
Yeah. So it's just something to kind of brace yourself for. A lot of our prog gods are getting old, you know? So
yeah, also, the other thing about that is the universe will probably end with a big crunch. And then everyone you cared about or know and love will disappear into a singularity.
Even better, forgotten. Before that, when thermodynamics ceased to be able to happen, the universe will experience heat death. Yep. Anyway, we got a couple, several billion years before that happens, so we're good for now as we pine existentially.
All right, let's get to this interview, man.
All right, let's do it. Matt Page from Dream the Electric Sleep, part two. This is a super interesting half because we talk about the realities of touring as a musician and we talk a little bit about the new album. So enjoy. Did the writing process feel markedly different on this album than the previous album, or is it just maybe more refined?
Yeah, I think it's always the same for us. We always... I will say that this time, every album, Chris and Joey have continued to contribute even more to the writing process. Not that they didn't before, but Chris wrote a lot of the stuff on this album this time.
Oh, cool.
So the way we do it is... either Joey will come into the rehearsal room with a drum beat that he wants to for us to start working around, or Chris will record something and post it, you know, on Facebook for us to listen to, or I'll do the same thing. I'll post something on Facebook to listen to it, and then we get together in the rehearsal room and we start, you know, writing it. We demo everything. We re-demo everything. I mean, it's an exhaustive process. But we do that. It's pretty much the same every time. And then we take those, we burn CDs and put them in our cars, and we drive around with them for months, you know, and go, I think we should do this here. We should have changed that. This vocal line sucks here. And so it's not like, it's not a fast process for us. We really put a lot of time and effort into thinking about, we'll tear whole songs apart after 3 months. Like, we'll love a song, and then 3 months later go, now we need to rip that thing apart. And so, our, you know, nothing is precious with us. It's like everything is open for debate always, even to the last second in the studio. And that happened this time with Nick. He was like, can we try changing this part around? Or can you play this drum beat instead of that drum beat? You know, here we are, like, we've spent months working on these songs. And it'll be like, that's cool. Like, you'll record it.
Let's try it.
And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But, you know... That's always our motto, is let's just, nothing is sacred, let's do everything we can to sort of turn over every stone. Like,
so it's product focused, like,
it is, yeah.
Rather than ego focused, which could be the tendency.
Yeah, if there's a solo that I love in a song, and they're like, man, I don't know that solo section, it's like, it's just not working. I don't bat an eye. Let's get it out of there then. If you guys think it's terrible...
Chances are
that it probably, you know, because you grow accustomed to listening to hearing something over and over again, and you just get used to it. So sometimes bad things sound good just because you're used to it.
That's true.
You know, and so to have somebody go, God, this thing is just not sitting with me right. And you go, all right, I trust you. I know that you have a good instinct. And I think we all in the band, if Chris comes in and says, man, can we try to change that drum beat around? Joey's like, yeah, let's try it. Let's do it. What do you think? How about something like this? So that's what's fun about it, though.
Right, yeah. So the collaborative aspect.
Oh, yeah. We laugh and have a good time. And, you know, that's the way it has to be. You know, and certainly as you get busier as a band, you know, and more things are happening, it's easy to get distracted from that. It's easy to sort of like let these other things invade that space, and so we're working really hard to protect that space because it can be ruined, I think, if you don't protect it.
Right, like Almost Famous, you know,
yeah.
And they're
yeah.
looking at the t-shirts and yeah. all that
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, you just want that space to be a naive, you know, play space where everything goes and, you know, no egos.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it's cool that you guys kind of have, you feel like you have this model or frame that by which you work, and you preserve it, like you work to preserve it.
Because Joey and I are cousins. We played together for 20 years.
Gosh, yeah.
So you know,
the rapport there.
So he and I, it's like we don't have to think about it. We just trust each other. He loves what I write. I love what he writes. And if something's not working for either of us, it's, you know, start over.
So would you say there's any... the risky question, competition at all? Do you think competition enters into your songwriting process at all?
With each other?
Yeah.
No.
Not at all?
None.
Because, you know, in bands that I played with, they'd say, there's some, like the Beatles, for example, or bands I played with, there, they say, well, I hear the song, I go, ooh, I want to write a song better, or I want a song. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, you know, I think instead of calling it competition, I would say that what we probably all realize is that we are each other's voice.
Oh, that's so cool.
You know, and so when I play, I'm playing for them. My hope is that what I do makes them proud and they feel like I'm speaking for them in the best possible way. And Chris and Joey, I know they feel exactly the same way. It's all about, it's that generosity thing. It's like, I'm playing for you guys, and you guys are playing for me. And when we do that, it's not so much competition. It's just that we're holding ourselves to a high standard to help those in our band. You know what I mean?
I get that. I will say I haven't talked to a trillion bands, but that seems like a rare thing and a very special thing.
Yeah, I think we recognize that. And so we are... grateful that we get to work together. You know what I mean?
That's
like,
really cool.
When we get together, it's like, this is so much fun, guys. Like, this is something that may not happen with every band.
Yeah.
Let's enjoy it. Let's have fun with it, you know, and take it as far as we can go with it. So, yeah, we recognize that it's a special bond.
Yeah.
And we want to preserve that bond, you know, and because I think it produces good music. And regardless of what style we're playing or where we go, as long as that's preserved, as long as that respect for each other and that generosity and that desire to reach as high as we can reach individually, because we know the higher we reach individually, the higher the overall reach of the band is, right? Mm-hmm. To that, whatever, wherever we're trying to reach for. And so we're just trying to keep that intact is really the number one goal.
That's awesome. Would you say... you mentioned that there's input from all three members, but would you say that there's a conceptual unity of the new album?
I mean, in terms of like sort of the conceptual lyrical side, that's all me. They basically said, Matt, whatever you want to write about, however you want to drive that part of the band, we trust you to do that. Now, that being said, I would say that they want to know what it is I'm writing about so we can write music that also supports those ideas.
Makes sense.
So, for instance, like on the new album, We Who Black Out the Sun, I said I want a song that sounds like a dust storm is coming. It hits, and then it leaves. And so that song, it took a while for it to happen, and there were many iterations of it, but that was like, okay, here's like, this is what I want at this point in the album. Can we make that happen? And then that's how we sort of built that particular song, which is just an instrumental song.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it needed to be for me to sort of get that picture, to project that picture in a musical way.
But as I guess as a counterpoint to the previous two albums, you wouldn't say this is as much a concept album as the previous ones. It's more like concept clusters.
Yeah, it's thematic for sure. It's about that time period with the Dust Bowl. So it's about you know, the economic crash. It's about the environmental devastation. It's about migration. It's about labor. It's about all of those things in that particular time period. It's not a linear story or linear narrative like the other two, so it is more thematic and clustered in the way that it works, because I was looking at photographs from Dorothea Lange. So each song I was looking at a photograph, and that was sort of like the lyrical touch point. And so the album is more like a series of photographs, I think, than it is a sort of like a film. That's sort of how I thought about it.
That's really cool. I watched a documentary on the Dust Bowl, and it's incredible. It's an incredible, harrowing story.
It is.
I like post-apocalyptic, and I think, oh, that...
Yeah, and it has so much to do with what we're talking about now. I mean,
Climate change.
Climate change and you know, economic disparity all over the world. You know, we haven't seen wealth inequity like this since the Great Depression, after the crash. And so there are all these common things that for me just felt like, how do we talk about what's happening now and also acknowledge that we've been here before? Because though it feels like forever ago, 80 years ago, it was a blink of the eye.
It's almost one or two lifetimes back.
The waves of history continue on long after sort of the impact. Mm-hmm. And so I still feel like those debates may have gone, you know, sort of under for a while, but they never went away. Like, what is progressivism? You know, why do we have, you know, Social Security? Why do we have the things that we have? And we take it for granted that it was in response to an enormous tragedy that was taking place in this country. It wasn't just because people thought, we should just give things away for free. It was because there was tremendous suffering, and if we did not rectify that problem, our country would have been
way different than
it is now. And so I don't think people are thinking long enough about where we are, why we are here. It's not by happenstance. Now, not that there haven't been mistakes made along the way, but you fix those mistakes.
Right,
you
know, yeah.
And so that, again, this is just me thinking about those waves of history and how we talk about it now and how the rhetoric now disregards that history in so many ways. And if we could think about that history in a more engaged way, it might change the rhetoric that we use to talk about the political and social issues we face now.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, because I remember one of my friends was telling me about art, and he had this really kind of pithy, profound statement, but he said, history tells you what happened and art tells you how it felt. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really cool, and that makes art sometimes even more powerful than just reading a history quote. You can read 100 people died in this town after this tragedy, but if you hear, I remember in my undergrad reading the poems of the Aztecs as they're being conquered. Mm. Like, hearing about it, you're just like, blah, blah, blah. Right. But you're reading, like, watching their civilization be devastated.
Right.
It's a totally different experience. It's a very human experience.
Right.
So it's cool that you kind of are able to share something that's human and universal in a way that... you know, that you can kind of feel what happened. You can feel the optimism. You can feel the struggle. Right. You know, it's really awesome.
Yeah, and you know, that was Dorothea Lange's hope with her photographs, was that her question was basically, can these aesthetic objects, these photographic artifacts, can they motivate change? Can they motivate people to feel differently about what's happening in other parts of the country, basically building empathy, and so that was also, that's something interesting to me. How does this sort of aesthetic artifact help motivate empathy, and does it? It was really a good question.
Yeah.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And when does it work? When does it not work? And I'm interested in all that stuff.
Yeah. We'll ask our listeners to comment.
Absolutely. Please. I'd love to know.
Yeah. So that's really cool. So the album's out, and it's just a couple days ago.
10
really.
Days, yeah, like something crazy like that.
So it's up for purchase. There are a lot of different ways you can get it. What do the next couple months look like for you guys?
You know, I would like to say that we're like a touring band, but at this point, we're not a touring band. We play some regional shows, and because a lot of our networking, industry networking, is in Europe, there are talks of us touring in Europe, and so we're sort of batting around that idea. But really, you know, we're writing again. I mean, we're a constant. That's the way we work. As soon as an album's out, it's like, in some ways, it's like we did our part. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like we did what we know how to do. And then, like I was saying earlier, then you release it and you let other people make it what it will be.
Right.
You know what I mean? And if it has any strengths or merit, it will be the public and the supporters that make that happen.
And, for sure,
and,
yeah.
And so I sort of see it as like, hey, our job is to write the best stuff we can write and produce the best music we can produce and get it out to the world. And we did that, and now we're kind of like, all right, good. Step.
We'll see what happens.
Let's see what happens, and let's start writing again, you know, and if we are fortunate enough to get on the road in Europe, great. But it's always a financial problem.
Sure.
I know all bands relate to that. That
especially in more niche bands.
Yeah, exactly. When you're a niche band, you know, packing up and getting on the road is expensive.
Yeah, right.
And I would love to pretend that we're like, you know, we don't have to consider those things, but that's the world of the modern musician, really, is trying to balance resources. And so we put a lot of resources into songwriting and album production, because that's how we know we can reach people that way.
Right. Yeah, different bands have different methods. Some bands survive on touring.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
And some bands kind of focus on the other element.
Yeah.
Do all the guys have other jobs they work and other careers and all that stuff?
We all have careers. You know, I teach at UK. Joey works at a local Big Ass Fans.
Nice.
and Chris is an art director at a screen printing company.
That's
so
cool.
We have day jobs. This is like we do what you hear is the product of us getting together 4 to 6 hours a week. And that's it. Like we would love to
be just a full-time
gig, but that's not the way it works. You know?
Not anymore, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that model from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, early 90s, I'm pretty sure that's a thing of the past.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool to watch movies about.
Right, exactly.
Totally unsustainable in the modern market.
It doesn't work that way.
But, you know, every kid that wants to be a rock star, it's like, go for it, man.
Yeah.
Or a girl or anybody, right. But just understand that the realities of what that looks like and what that is. And be realistic about it. And I think what it sounds like with you guys is you guys are, you know, this is a reason to get up out of bed. This is like
I always say it's like my church.
Yeah.
It's like my religion. It's like the thing that I practice every day. It's the thing that allows me to process the world. I process the world through playing music and I share my thoughts about the world through this thing. I think, you know, part of the problem is that the industry, if you just look at it from the top, from the surface of it, it looks similar to what was happening in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. The goal is still to project that everything's fine.
Yeah.
That the rock star exists, that the rock and roll dream exists. Unfortunately, when you start getting further into the industry, you go, oh, that's just to make people, that's just to sell the fantasy still.
Yeah.
It really is. And I think that listeners would be better served knowing that the people you think are rock stars are not rock stars. They live in crappy apartments and they tour all year long just to eat. It's not what you see on the magazine covers, unless you are one of the bands that already made it back in the like 90s, early 2000s. I mean,
or if you're willing to sing some Norwegian guy's pop song and wear this designer's clothes,
right, and be an entertainer, which is fine. You know, like that's fine. The world wants to be entertained right now. It doesn't want what we have to offer, which is not entertainment. Not that it can't be entertaining, but we don't wear the you know,
designer
clothes or wear vests with chains and makeup. We don't do that. It's an investment in art, and that's what people, I think that's what people like about what we do. Even though it's not like huge, there's enough people in the world that want that I'm happy to say, great, if you want music that's invested in art and ideas and craftsmanship, then you might like what we do. And if you want an entertainer, then go listen to pop music or radio rock. You know, like, that's pure spectacle. It has very, right. It's very one-dimensional. But that's what a lot of people want.
Right. Well, for what it's worth, I think I definitely think it's valuable, and I think our listeners think it's valuable. So we appreciate what you do, even if it's a struggle. You know,
right.
I was reading about Devin Townsend a while back. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite musicians, yeah, but he told some magazine about how much he made,
right. Yeah, I read that.
And yeah. You know, everybody was just like, "What?"
Yeah, you know, some people need to know that.
Some fans said, "I make more than my favorite musician. That just feels wrong."
Yeah.
But, you know, he was just like, yeah. And so you have this thing going on. You have this perception going on. But at the same time, you're making money, and you're getting to do something that just totally, like, fills you up, gives you purpose and gives you life. When I saw his Royal Albert Hall show, I was just like, that guy looks so happy on stage.
Yeah, sure.
Like,
he's following. It's all about, you know, like you said, following that passion that he's got, the thing that fills him up. I think it's dangerous to think that if you just surface read the music industry, to think that things are anywhere close to what they used to be. That's just to keep the fantasy alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real.
Yeah, and they weren't even that great. I mean, we see all the behind the musics about those bands. Like, they always end up in, like, rehab, and,
yeah.
You know, it was unsustainable then.
Yeah.
And... It's just impossible now.
Yeah, I'm interested in sustainability. I want a music practice that is sustainable so that I can continue to make good music for people that want good music. Like, if I crash and burn, if anybody crashes and burns, I mean, how much talent is in this world that has crashed and burned because life tends to make that happen?
Yeah,
and
it does.
To try and find a way to keep it going, even if it's 4 to 6 hours a week. I have summers off, and that's when we record albums. So this last album was recorded last summer. And just now getting released, because I had summers off, I was able to live in Nashville for 6 weeks and record the album. But that's because I spent a long time figuring out, how do I incorporate music into a regular person's life? How do I create professional music in the life of a person that is just a regular, average person? You know,
like, yeah.
And that's been my thought since, like, 18. Like, how do I do that? And I think I figured out a way to do it.
It sounds like it's to me. It sounds like it's a cool balance.
Yeah,
a cool balance of things.
Yeah,
you have your vocation. You have, like, this, your passion. And,
right.
And sometimes they intersect.
Sometimes
but
they don't. Yeah.
Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much. We're going to do one more thing. I think I told you it was a surprise, but I didn't tell you what it was going to be. But this is a pretty important Proglodytes tradition. So I didn't prep you at all for this.
I have no idea.
Alright. Would you rather have moose antlers or an elephant trunk?
Moose antlers and elephant trunk. I think I'm gonna go with the elephant trunk.
Yeah.
I think I could make more use of that thing. It's like having an extra arm with a couple of fingers at the end. Like,
oh, that's true.
You know, like, so, like, I can play guitar, and I could actually, like, maybe, like, play some keyboard notes with my trunk.
That's true.
You know,
it is kind of like an extra appendage.
It is, and then you know, then I've got my feet. I can keep the kick drum going. I can, you know, like, I could do a lot more with that one extra arm there. And you can squirt water on yourself, so when you're on stage, you can stay cool. Definitely. That's wrong. I can't think of what I would do with those moose antlers. They would look badass, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you could hang stuff on them.
That's true. You could put, like, tambourines on there and shake your head around in time.
That's true.
I'm thinking solely music.
Yeah, it's like...
Other benefits, I'm not sure, but from musical standpoints, they both have pluses and minuses, I think.
Right, yeah. All right. Next question. Would you rather be President of the United States, which is a job I don't think any sane person would want, or be the president of a failing record label? Just a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, President of the United States or president of a failing record label?
Yeah.
Gosh. You know, the good citizen in me would say be president of the United States because I would love to be able to contribute to the direction of the world, but I probably would be a better president of a failing record label.
Yeah.
I think I probably have those.
You're idealistic enough that you might think that it would work down to the very last minute.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would try and restructure the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah.
It would still fail, but, you know, I would try.
Very good. And the last question, if you could be any animal, what animal would you be?
Gosh, no, I could be really cliche and say I'd like to be a crow or a vulture. I actually think vultures, I live on a farm and I watch vultures, and of course everyone thinks vultures are disgusting, but if we didn't have vultures, our world would be a disgusting place.
Plus it's kind of cool that they're scavenging. There's always going to be some dead body somewhere.
There was like a town in India that like hated vultures, and they killed all the vultures that they could, and then they were like, why does our town smell so bad? So they got to get rid of the vultures. Anyway, those things can fly way up there, and I've always wanted to fly. I have dreams of flying all the time. So I'm going to go with vulture.
All right.
I'll be a good citizen. I'll clean up the mess of the world, and I'll fly in the process. Like, that sounds like a win-win to me.
I like it. I like the vulture. I wouldn't have guessed that, but it's starting to make sense.
Right.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, Matt. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, check out their new album. It's coming out, or it's already out, and the links are below the interview spot on the webpage. And check them out and buy their album. Support this great band.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem.
Proglodytes Radio Podcast was created and is co-hosted by Arthur and Thomas Hatton and is co-produced by Arthur Hatton and Jim Britt.